All right, this is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in the Department of History. Today is November 15th, 2013, and I am interviewing Gordon Oswald over the telephone. He's currently in London, and we are going to talk about his experiences with the Climate Change Institute. So, just to get us started off, I'm wondering if you can tell me about how you got attracted to this interesting combination of radar and glaciers.
Okay. First of all, Adam, let me just tell you, England is not London. I'm near Cambridge rather than London, and so I'm giving this interview from a small village in the countryside near Cambridge, about 60 miles north of London. So, I studied physics at university. I went to work for what was then called the Atomic Energy Authority in England on a nuclear reactor. And while I was there, I saw an opportunity to join the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge. That was working on a research project with the U.S. Navy and the National Science Foundation and the U.S. Antarctic Research Project, using radar to measure the thickness and the topography of the Antarctic ice sheet. I joined the project, went to the institute, went to Antarctica. Frankly, I got addicted to radar, and the first thing that I got involved with was this issue of measuring the thickness of the ice. But I found in the course of that project that you could use the radar to do other things, like decide whether the ice was lying on rock or whether it was lying on a water interface. And that just fascinated me, that you could be flying thousands of feet in the air with this instrument that basically looked through the ice and could measure things under the ice. And that's where I got addicted to radar, and that's where the connection with geophysics and Arctic ice happened to me.
Gordon, when were you in Antarctica?
This was 1970, the winter of the Northern Hemisphere winter, Southern Hemisphere summer of 71-72.
So you were there for what, a couple of months?
Yes.
I see. Were there any physical hardships that you can remember experiencing while you were there?
10-hour flights in a C-130. With your head at about 80 degrees and your feet and your boots are about minus 40, that wasn't very pleasant. Nothing really serious in terms of the sorts of things that happened to Scott and Amundsen and the other Antarctic explorers. We were served food at 6-hour intervals, and you could have steak, or you could have cornflakes, or you could have salad at any time. So, frankly, no, there weren't great physical hardships, except for the flying, and I would say that that took a lot of endurance.
Mm-hmm. So these flights were basically you traveling from one part of Antarctica to another?
Well, not really. No, we were based at McMurdo Base, McMurdo Sound, in Antarctica. The aircraft was dedicated to us. We would take off. We were flying 2 10-hour sorties in a day. That is, one half of the team would do one, and then the other half would do another. We would take off. We would fly for 8 to 10 or more hours, and then we would fly a pattern across the ice sheet. So our survey was a well-organized set of flight paths. And then we would return to McMurdo. So, no, it was point A to point A.
And so the actual research you conducted while on the plane itself.
Exactly. So I didn't explain that properly. The instrument, the radar, is mounted on the aircraft. As you fly along at some identified height above the ice sheet, the radar looks down through the ice. And as you fly along, you record the results of what the radar is seeing, and the things it sees are a first reflection, a top reflection from the upper surface of the ice, then the radar signal travels through the ice, reflects off the bottom of the ice, and then back up through the surface to the aircraft. And the recording system records all of the information that the radar generates, and it tells you as it flies, as the aircraft flies along, it tells you what the vertical profile of the ice is. But it also tells you information that you might, that we didn't expect, about the nature of the interface between the ice and the rock beneath.
And what was it that you didn't expect?
We didn't expect to find that there was water under the ice.
Water between the ice and the rock, basically.
That's correct. And what that means is that the bed of the ice was found to be melting in places where it wasn't expected to be melting.
Was this an early sign of global warming?
No, it wasn't. The ice is 2, 3, 4 kilometers thick. It would take 100,000 years for a temperature signal to travel from the top of the ice to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
What it is a sign that the state of the ice sheet is not as simple and possibly not as stable as might have been thought. Numerical models had been constructed of the Antarctic ice sheet, and they had suggested that the temperature at the bed would be somewhere in the minus 10, minus 20, minus 30 degrees region. And we were able to prove that that isn't the case, that the ice is much closer to melting, and in some cases is actually melting at the base. But the outside world, the atmosphere around us, the climate, has not had time yet to affect the temperature at the bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just if climate change moves in a certain direction, then we may find that the conditions at the edge of the ice sheet change quite quickly, in which case the stability of the ice as it is will come into play. The question will be, how quickly will it respond to changes at the edge and at the surface?
Hmm. And did you learn anything interesting from the radar images of the ice itself, aside from what you learned that you didn't expect to learn?
We found extreme topography. We found how deep we could look through it. We found that in previous years, sometimes the bed was difficult, the bed of the ice, the rock or water, was difficult to see. We found that we were able to measure the thickness pretty continuously through the flights. We found mountains, many of them were thought to be there, but the sensation of flying along in an aircraft 5,000 feet above a completely white, flat surface. If you looked out of the window, there were no features on the upper surface of the ice. And yet the radar was telling you that there were 10,000-foot mountains buried underneath it. So from a personal perception point of view, I was learning things every flight.
Incredible. So how did you come to get affiliated with the Institute?
It was quite a long story. I did my PhD at Cambridge in the UK at the Scott Polar Research Institute. And having done that, I worked for myself for a while, developing electronics music equipment. And then I joined a company called Cambridge Consultants, in Cambridge, of course, which is a technology development consulting company. And they do a lot of engineering, innovative engineering of new products, communication systems, medical products, some government work, all sorts of things that need innovation in their development, and I felt at home there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after about 25 years there, one of the applications that we identified, and most of the work that I had done was on radar of one sort or another, be it for government customers, for oil companies, exploration in the Arctic, industrial customers with various types of instrumentation. After that, I found myself working for car companies because short-range radar is very useful for warning of impending collisions between vehicles. And I worked for those companies for several years and then found that the thing that made new technology accepted or not accepted in industries like that was not necessarily how good the technology was, but the structure of the industry and the companies in the industry, their suppliers, their supply chain, and whether they were ready for what they think of as disruptive technology. The truth is they don't like disruptive technology. So working for them was very interesting, but also very frustrating. So I decided that I wasn't quite finished with the work that I had done at the Scott Polar Research Institute, and that I liked the idea of going back to that to do some more of it. And I happened to visit a town in Maine, which is near Orono, which my wife had identified as a good place to visit, because we were living in Boston at the time. To explain that, Cambridge Consultants was owned by an American company, Arthur D. Little, which was based in Boston, and I was working at the head office there. Now, in Castine, I went into a bookshop and I bought a book by Paul Majewski, and he was the director, of course, of the Climate Change Institute, and I thought, well, this is very interesting stuff, and this relates to things that I worked on at that time. It was 30 years before or more. So I decided to get in touch with him, which I did, and he offered me the opportunity of a part-time position at the Institute, whereby I could pursue a further interest in the use of radar to identify the state and behavior and possible future behavior of ice sheets. I took him up on that offer, agreed a change to my working contract with Cambridge Consultants, and since then have been working as a part-time faculty member at the Climate Change Institute. That's sort of the story as far as it goes at this point.
Mm-hmm. What was the book?
It was The Ice Chronicles.
Mm. And
that's Paul Majewski's book.
Mm-hmm. And what are your actual specific responsibilities within the Institute?
I'm purely a research professor. I do research work. I write proposals for research funding. If I get the research funding, I work on the funding, and if I don't, then I work on my own nickel.
Mm.
I've also done some supervision. I've given talks in the institute. I form a link because I have a collaborative research program with the University of Kansas. I form a link between the institute and the University of Kansas, and particularly the Center for Remote Sensing of Ice Sheets, or CRESIS, as it's known.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the story, and in fact, I'm currently writing the final report for the National Science Foundation research grant that I have at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And are you currently working with any other members of the Institute?
I work with Roger Hook.
Mm-hmm.
I work with Jim Fastuk.
Are you currently working on something now together?
They are currently expecting a new product from me, which is a new set of maps of the water beneath the Greenland ice sheet. And that should arrive in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I believe that when they have that, they will be able to, one of them will be able to review that and consider what it means for the physical nature of the ice sheet. The other will be able to make use of it in determining how Jim Fastuk is involved with computer modeling of the ice sheet, and he'll be able to use that to compare with his model outputs.
Mm-hmm. And what about Roger?
Roger is retired.
Mm-hmm.
He takes a broad interest in new information about the structure of ice sheets and the flow of glaciers and what the lower surface, what the bed of the ice is like, and he will review what I produce and tell me whether he thinks it makes sense in terms of the physics of the ice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before that day in Castine when you found that book by Paul, mm-hmm. had you heard of the Climate Change Institute?
No, I had not.
Because you had kind of been out of academia for a while.
A long time.
Yeah.
In fact, it was just over 30 years.
Mm-hmm. When you were in academia, so that was the early 70s, I take it?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Had you heard of the Institute for Quaternary Studies?
No, I hadn't. I did know of Terry Hughes because he was engaged in the same area as myself and Chris Harrison, who was one of the other research students at the Scott Polar Research Institute. And there were various publications that dealt with similar subjects. And he was at Maine, but I did not know of the Institute for Quaternary Studies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One question that I'd like to ask those I interview, it seems that the human role in climate change is not really very much debated within the scientific community. It's fairly well established. But in American political culture, it's debated. It's hotly debated. And I'm wondering if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
That's a very good question. In fact, on the TV, on television in the UK last night, there is a weekly program called Question Time, in which a panel of politicians answer questions to an audience on subjects of moment. And the question of the recent IPCC report came up, and what action should be taken. And one of the politicians was a venerable conservative politician, UK British politician, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is a fairly powerful, it's the equivalent of Treasury Secretary in the US.
Yes.
Quite a long time ago he was in that position. And he is a denier of climate change. So we have them here as well. It's very hard to know how to deal with people who take that view, because it's difficult to see it as, I mean, I'm telling you, this is opinion. It's difficult to see it as a rational position to take. And it's mostly, but of course not always, taken by people who don't understand the need for a scientist to say, this is what I have found to be true, but this is the limits of the certainty of my knowledge. These are the limits of the certainty of my knowledge. And when you say that, you admit that the alternative interpretation could still be true. And that's different from the way that uncertainty is presented in non-scientific circles. And I think part of the problem is about the difference between political circles in which certainty is everything and scientific circles in which the degree of uncertainty is the important thing. So the same thing happens in this country. Unfortunately, it is not a rational process that properly weights the level of acceptance or certainty on one side of the argument with the opposite side of the argument. Always 50% exposure must be given to both sides of an argument.
Mm.
And we seem to be in this situation. I think what really lies under it is that people don't like to hear what they don't like to hear. They don't want to believe that we have caused a problem.
Right.
They don't want to believe that we've caused a problem and therefore threatened future generations and the cost of trillions of dollars to try to recover the situation. I've always felt that that's not a rational way to approach things. You have to measure what you can measure. You have to make the best judgment you can according to the models that you have as to what's happening. And in fact, I decided in my own mind that things like this were happening at least 10 years before I even heard of the Climate Change Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say I wasn't open-minded. People would say that, but I believe that is a rational response to what we believe the best things we can say about what we know about the climate.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any differences between the UK and America in terms of how much of the population does not buy into the idea of human-caused climate change?
I don't know. In fact, I really don't know what the numbers actually are. I have impressions, but I don't know if they're useful to you. My impressions are that on the coastal regions of the U.S., it's quite well understood, but in the middle of America, it's not. But that's just an impression. It has no basis in fact at all. In the UK, I would say that many, many people, other than those on what you would call the conservative, I wouldn't hesitate to say fringe, but well on the conservative wing, have a quite good perception that things aren't what they were, particularly in this country, The U.S. is a big place, and it has a climate that is quite well defined from coast to center to coast, from Arctic north to, or near Arctic north to tropical south. The UK's climate is completely wrong for its geographical location. We are on the same latitude as Labrador. And the only reason that we have a survivable climate is because of the Gulf Stream. Have you heard of the Gulf Stream?
Yes, I have.
Good. Mm-hmm. The Gulf Stream keeps Northern Europe warm, much warmer than it should be. And therefore, we are dependent on a climate feature whose stability we have no knowledge of. There's no reason why it should be particularly stable. So I'd say there is a perception in this country. The weather is always changing here, and there's no particular faith that it will always stay warm and damp, as it has been.
What do you think has been the Climate Change Institute's most important contribution to climate science?
I would say it's the linking together of the physical issues of climate change with social, medical, historical, a whole range of fields of human interest that will be affected by a change in climate. Paul Majewski has brought all those things together, developing from the Institute of Quaternary and Climate Science into something that is avowedly the Climate Change Institute, and ensured that the focus is spread, not just is not constrained within narrow climatological or geological or geophysical studies, but to a much wider range of activity. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all the questions I have, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't ask you about.
Okay, thank you. I think that if there is anything further to say, it is that I believe that Paul's objective in instituting the Climate Change Institute was to make this clear, to make the fact that is the issue that anyone in the sort of field should be addressing, we need to engage many scientific disciplines and medical and other disciplines in that activity. And its success is tightly bound with the success of the overall, what is really a political struggle to respond to what is the one of the driving features of the development of human occupation of the world.
All right. Well, thank you for your very interesting remarks. And I will go ahead and stop the recording now.
Okay.